The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Hi, I'm Kevin. I'm the host for this evening, and it's a real privilege to introduce Patrice Kelch, who doesn't really need an introduction. She's very well known at Common Ground. She's been practicing here for a very long time. She started her meditation in 1994, is that what you're saying? She's well loved.
Very nice.
She underwent community Dharma leader training at Spirit Rock
with my friend Mira.
Mira Young. She did a year of chaplaincy training at the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies in Redwood City. And most recently, she has led a men's meditation group at the Stillwater Correctional Facility. Big Common Ground welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you all so much for being here tonight. What I thought I'd talk about is trying to think about what had been helpful to me in my own practice. And I thought about the metaphors that had been helpful to me in practice. So that's what I'd like to share with you tonight and hope we can discuss. And some of you may have some of your own that you'll be willing to share at the end of this. On my very, very first long retreat, which was about eight or nine days, back probably in 95 or 96, after I'd been practicing a year or two, it was with Kamala Masters. And I just remember Kamala said, "Impatience is the great thief of our practice." And this metaphor just totally galvanized me at the time because I was so restless. I had this monkey mind. I was disappointed that I wasn't having, blissful experiences, that I was just so antsy, and it was harder than I thought it would be. And having this wonderful image that impatience was going to rob me of my practice, impatience was the thief of my practice, really was helpful for me in sticking it out and in just managing to sit with and through that restlessness and sit with all of that disappointment that I wasn't a better meditator. So it was very helpful to me in my own practice. And so I thought I would talk about some of the other metaphors that have been helpful throughout my practice. And if my experience is at all typical, and I've been practicing now for about 20 years, and I'm guessing it's more typical than not, has had kind of a trajectory. And the first part is I practiced to fix what was broken. So dissatisfaction with the life my way was going, issues about career, some relationships. I wasn't working hard enough or smart enough to with respect to the things that mattered. And I was trying to make peace with the conditions in my life, but it was mostly this idea of something broken needing to be fixed. And it's really interesting because we often think about something broken being more often than not some object, something mechanical. It's not a very organic or holistic kind of image. Pretty mechanical. And I think that was sort of the way I looked at myself in this very instrumentalist kind of approach to myself. And the second phase of practice in this trajectory is what I think about as practice to be perfect. And it's not so much the broken self, but wanting to perfect the self. And this is, really, kind of a healthy thing because there's a lot of focus on cultivation of virtue, of living with integrity. And I think for many of us, this is really a big, 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 very wholesome, in lots of ways, very wholesome, very fruitful part of practice, that we really are working on a kind of deep integrity, becoming a better person in a way, that purification of the heart and mind, seeing cause and effect more clearly. And then the third a way of moving in this trajectory is finally to practice to awaken with the goal of awakening and the idea of not being a better self, but of being ultimately free. And I think that that comes further along in practice when out of years of practice, you have much more confidence in the practice. And the metaphors I'm going to talk about tonight are metaphors that kind of follow that trajectory. So these are some of the metaphors that have anchored me as I've drifted around. In the literatures of many cultures, both ancient and contemporary, there are three dominant metaphors to characterize the living of a human life. There's the metaphor that life is a garden. There's the metaphor that life is a journey. And there's the metaphor that life is a river. And you sort of see this over and over again in stories, in poetry, very, very common metaphors. And so too in the Pali scriptures, the scriptures that were written shortly after the time of the Buddha, we see that there are very significant metaphors of cultivation, of following a path, and of entering a river. And these are all metaphors that are used to convey our immersion in an understanding of the Dharma. I want to first make a little disclaimer before I jump into them, though. People who've been practicing here for a while know that we've all learned to be really, really wary of concepts. That we have a concept of color, for example, that's very different than just the experience of seeing color. Or we have a concept of a chair, or whatever. We think in concepts all the time. And one of the things that we try to do in practice is to really distinguish what is a concept and what's not. And a lot of us have really, Mark has really trained us well to really keep our antennae out for mistaking concepts for the way things are. But concepts have a real utility, and I found this great short piece by, it's either pronounced Tanisaro Biko or Tanisaro Biku. I've heard it both ways. I don't know which, so I may flip-flop back and forth, but everyone knows the printed name because he is a prolific, and wonderful translator and writer. But I found this great little essay called The Raft of Concepts that I thought might be helpful as we engage with metaphor in a wholesome way. The Buddha once said that after all his years of false starts and dead-end alleys, he finally got onto the path when he realized that he should divide his thoughts into two types, skillful and unskillful. This meant that he judged his thoughts by the results they gave. He didn't say that all thinking was bad. He did say that if you thought skillful thoughts for 24 hours, the drawback would be that the body and mind would get tired. So you want to learn simply how to rest from thinking. But he never said that the conceptual mind is bad. It's simply a matter of learning how to use concepts properly. That's the path. It's part of right view and right resolve. These factors of the path involve thoughts. So we can't condemn thoughts entirely. We just need to know how to think in ways that are actually skillful, that help free the mind. Ultimately, you do get to a place that's beyond concepts, that goes beyond words, but you need concepts and words to help you get there. This is a point a lot of people misunderstand. They think that in order to get beyond concepts, you just drop concepts immediately. It's like the old simile of the raft. The version in the Buddha's teaching is that you take the raft across the river. Then once you get across the river, you don't need the raft anymore. You can put it aside. Thoughts of right view and thoughts of right resolve are part of the raft. You hold on to them while you're crossing the river, and only then do you get to put them aside. Okay. So I'm going to get back to the image of the raft closer to the end of my talk. But I want to talk about now the really skillful aspects of metaphors. So let's go back to the metaphor of the garden. Gardens are always intentional. The gardener has an idea of what he or she wants to grow, and the gardener has to pay attention to the conditions that support the development of the plant. So in our practice, we learn to cultivate skillful states of mind and skillful actions based on the intention not to harm ourselves or others. So instead of fixing ourselves as if we were defective pieces of machinery, we shift to cultivating right or wise effort. And the way the Buddha described wise effort, or right effort, and this is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, it is guarding against unskillful or unwholesome mental states that have not yet arisen. So we guard against the arising of these unskillful, unwholesome states of mind. Abandoning unwholesome mental states that have arisen. Developing wholesome states that have yet to arise, and maintaining the wholesome mental states that have arisen. So this is a great analogy to what goes on in the garden, we guard against certain sorts of plants getting in. We get rid of them if they're in there. We try to cultivate the plants that we want to grow, and we work really hard on nourishing or maintaining the plants that that we've intended. So the mind is a lot like that. And that the cultivation, the other dominant metaphor that we get in the suttas about cultivation is one about uprooting. And it's uprooting the causes of unskillful thoughts and actions. So, we uproot greed, hatred, and delusion. Just as a very experienced gardener sees and uproots plants, and, the more skillful the gardener, I often have to wait till I see, what the leaf is, what's really, things sometimes have to get pretty far along before I can recognize whether it belongs in my garden or not. But a really skillful gardener knows immediately when something starts to sprout, whether it's something that she or he wants in the garden. And so, too, with our practice, that as we get more and more skillful, we see more subtle manifestations of, instead of just greed, gross greed, we see more subtle manifestations of attachment instead of something as gross as hate. As we get more skillful, we notice that first sprouting of aversion, and we get more and more sensitive to when we're being deluded. So again, this is a wonderful sort of metaphor, and it can really anchor us to our practice, because sometimes, it has for me really helped to say, okay, this is a really unskillful thought, and what I really have to do is just change the channel, have to uproot it. That's really mixing metaphors, change the channel, but but I really need to uproot it. I need to need to get rid of it. So sometimes having that image is just really helpful in really anchoring us to our practice. And the metaphor of the garden also really primed me to recognize the fruits of my practice, that it helped me see when there was some ease in my practice. Oh, this is a fruit of what I've been doing. Those moments of ease, of non-clinging, of being responsive instead of reactive. And in many cases, I could see how the seeds of my intention took root and bore the fruit of skillful mental and bodily speech. So the image of the seeds, of planting the seeds, our intentions, the seeds, and of not only planting the seeds, but really recognizing the fruits of practice. That's why when we first came together tonight, I really encouraged you to think about the fact that you were able to be here tonight, that you were able to follow through on intention. Because someone else who was in our CDL group, Brick Hansen, who's written a book called Hardwiring Happiness, says that, you know, we sort of have Velcro for the bad and Teflon for the good, that we're all really aware of what's our mistakes or what's wrong. And this is, again, mixing metaphors. But when we do something good, we tend to not really take it in. So I've thought in my own practice, it's really important to really have my antennae out for when something is a real fruit of practice, when I have that moment of not saying something that in the past I might have said. So that's another fruit of practice. The second great metaphor is the metaphor of the journey, and that, of course, is a natural for Buddhist practice because we talk so much and our practice really is the Eightfold Noble Path, the path to the end of suffering. So I want to read the way the Buddha describes this. So the Buddha says, "So practitioners, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. I followed that path, and by doing so, I have directly known aging and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation." So the Buddha talks about the Eightfold Path not as something that he invented, but an ancient path that he rediscovered, and that we're encouraged to follow this path to the end, to the cessation. And some of the ways the cessation is described, there are many, many words that are used in talking about this endpoint, Nibbana, which is in the Pali really needs a kind of cooling. It is the unformed, the unconditioned, the end, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the everlasting, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the blessed, safety, the wonderful, the marvelous, purity, freedom, the island, the refuge, the beyond. And it's been interesting to me that the Buddha talks about this sometimes also as the farther shore, the island, the refuge. So in addition to the more like the marvelous, the wonderful, in addition to those more intangible descriptions, He also gives us these metaphors of the island, the other shore, the refuge. So this is the end point of our practice. And I've always thought that this idea of the journey on the path is an especially useful image in reconciling ourselves to the changing topography of our practice over time and in different circumstances. I mean, there may be times when practice just seems like it's just slogging on, that the mind is all over the place, that things are really rough, and you're just putting sort of one foot in front, one sit after another, and you're just doing that to and, you know, for I expect that many people here have had experiences hiking or trekking, and know that sometimes it's just like that. It's not fun, and you're just putting one foot in front of the other because you're determined to walk the path. I think about, you know, sort of, you may spend, and many of us have, seems like we do nothing but traverse the boulder field of right speech. You know, you can work on that just about forever, working on that aspect of the path. And often it does seem like traversing a boulder field. And, you know, then you're done with it and you get this great stretch of the path where you have mindfulness and you have ease and you have concentration. And then, you know, you're back at the boulder field or another boulder field. And, you know, this is what we learn as we walk through the path, and we see some of the same kinds of topography over and over again, that, like the trekker, we get more skillful at it. Right speech again, I need to work on that. Coming back to it again, that part of the path, you'll have more skill as you work on it. So we do fewer misreadings of the trail, I'd say, and we become more effective in using our energy and focusing our energy skillfully. I'm guessing many people in here, since it's such a popular read, have read Cheryl Strayed's Wild. Not okay, some people have, which is a story about trekking the Pacific Coast Trail with complete ignorance and no preparation. Just an amazing story of putting one foot in front of another. But it is the sort of thing that I think it's a metaphor that comes very naturally to us. And for me, this kind of anchors me to think, okay, I'm on a path. I have a goal. I just don't know how long it's going to take me to be there, to get there. And I'm pretty, I get more and more familiar with what I might encounter on the path in working with right speech, right action, with mindfulness. And then there's another topological description of a kind of gradual progression. And the Buddha talks about his teaching as a gradual path, that it's a path that takes a while. And this one was new to me until this year. And the Buddha said, just as the ocean has a gradual shelf, a gradual slope, a gradual inclination, with a sudden drop-off only after a long stretch, in the same way, this doctrine and discipline has a gradual training, a gradual performance, a gradual progression, with a penetration to gnosis, only after a long stretch. And the word gnosis is used in many of the translations to English because the Greek word gnosis generally means a kind of insightful knowledge or understanding. It's a common Greek noun for knowledge, and it also is very much associated with like a spiritual penetration. So this was sort of amazing to me at the time of the Buddha, that they knew that there was this gradual ocean shelf, and suddenly you get to a drop-off. And many of us know here, Kyoko Katayama, who teaches here sometimes and is a community member. And she told us about having this experience scuba diving off the coast of Mexico, where she said, you know, just for a long time, it was, you know, the fish and the corals, and it's getting deeper, and it's beautiful. And then she said, and then suddenly, it just dropped off, and you were just suspended in this universe of blue water with no sense of boundaries or top or bottom. And she said it was just an incredible, total sort of experience. And this is a metaphor that the Buddha used in his time to talk about what our experience of understanding could be, that for a long time we are on this sort of gradual incline of the ocean floor, and at some point it just drops off, and we have this sort of penetrating insight, and all the old concepts, all the old markers that we have to orient ourselves, all of that is just gone. And we're just there completely, completely present in the present moment. So it's a very, to me, it's a very stirring and kind of exciting image of the path. And then finally, the metaphor of the river. And in the Buddha's time, the Buddha lived on the Gangetic Plain in ancient India. So that's a river that has a big floodplain. It's an enormous river. It's a holy river. And it was a very major force in the life of the people of what we now think of as North Central India. So I've got a sutta to read to you. This is the Sutta of the Raft, but it's an extremely dramatic sutta with the title Vipers. It's the Asavisa Sutta. And it says, I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Savathi in Jetta's grove. Then he addressed the monks. Monks, suppose there were four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom. Then a man would come along, desiring life, desiring not to die, desiring happiness, and loathing pain. And people would tell him, good man, these four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom are yours. Time after time, they must be lifted up. Time after time, they must be bathed. Time after time, they must be fed. Time after time, put to rest. And if any of these vipers ever gets angered with you, then you will meet with death or death-like suffering. Do what you think should be done. Then the man, afraid of the four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom, would flee this way or that. Then the people would tell him, good man, there are five enemy executioners chasing right on your heels. They are thinking, whenever we see him, we'll kill him right on the spot. Do what you think should be done. Then the man, afraid of the four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom, afraid of the five enemy executioners, would flee this way or that. The people would tell him, good man, there is a sixth executioner, a fellow traveler, chasing right on your heels with upraised sword, thinking, whenever I see him, I'll kill him on the spot. Good man, do what you think should be done. Then the man, afraid of the four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom, afraid of the five enemy executioners, afraid of the sixth fellow traveling executioner with upraised sword, would flee this way or that. He would see an empty village. Whatever house he entered would be abandoned, void, and empty as he entered it. Whatever pot he grabbed hold of would be abandoned, void, and empty as he grabbed hold of it. They would tell him, good man, right now, village plundering bandits are entering this empty village. Do what you think should be done. Then the man, afraid of the four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom, afraid of the five enemy executioners, afraid of the sixth fellow traveling executioner with upraised sword, afraid of the village plundering bandits, would flee this way or that. He would see a great expanse of water. with the near shore dubious and risky, and the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. The thought would occur to him, here is this great expanse of water, with the near shore dubious and risky, the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. What if I were to gather grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and having bound them together to make a raft, or to cross over to safety on the other shore, independence on the raft, making an effort with my hands and feet. Then the man, having gathered grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, having bound them together to make a raft, would cross over to safety on the other shore, independence on the raft, making an effort with his hands and feet. Crossed over, having gone to the other shore, he would stand on high ground. Monks, I have made this simile to convey a meaning. Here is the meaning in this. The four vipers of utmost heat and horrible venom stand for the four great existences: the earth property, the liquid property, the fire property, and the wind property. And in the Buddha's time, people understood that all things were composed of those elements. So those are sort of the basic building blocks of physical things. The five enemy executioners stand in for the five clinging aggregates. So sometimes we talk about the aggregates, which are our experience, the form clinging aggregate, the feeling clinging aggregate, the perception clinging aggregate, the fabrications clinging aggregate, the consciousness clinging aggregate. The sixth fellow traveling executioner with the upraised sword stands for passion and delight. So what the Buddha is saying in this part of the simile is that those aspects of the mind, perception, feeling, mental formations, consciousness, that all of those are ways that we cling. And then the empty village stands for the six internal sense media. If a wise, competent, intelligent person examines them from the point of view of the eye, they appear abandoned, void, and empty. If he examines them from the point of view of the ear, the nose, the tongue, etc., they appear abandoned, void, and empty. The village plundering bandits stand for the six external sense media. So it's what comes in through those sense doors that are the bandits. The eye is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable forms. The ear is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable sounds. The nose is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable aromas. The tongue is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable flavors. The body is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable tactile sensations. The intellect is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable ideas. The great expanse of water stands for the fourfold flood: the flood of sensuality, the flood of becoming, the flood of views, and the flood of ignorance. The near shore, dubious and risky, stands for self-identification. The further shore, secure and free from risk, stands for unbinding. And unbinding is another synonym for nibbana. So it's for that farther shore, the liberation. The raft stands for just this noble eightfold path: right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Making an effort with hands and feet stands for the arousing of persistence. Crossed over, having gone to the other shore, he would stand on the high ground. He would stand as an arahant. So this is this image about liberation. And it's about really, and this sort of dramatic idea about the vipers and the executioner, and to really stir up the monks to be more ardent and vigilant. One of the things that is often said of the Buddha's teaching is that he was a really great pedagogue, in the sense that he really taught to the students who were there at the moment. So I suspect that the monks that he was working with in this particular case maybe were not as diligent and ardent as he might have hoped. So he gave him this very, very stirring image of the vipers and the executioners. But the idea of the Eightfold Path as a raft, and that is our persistence with this, using our hands and feet, which stands for persistence, that that is really the way we can move to liberation. And the flood of heat, and what we're crossing over is this the flood of sensuality, the appeal of sensual desires. It's not that sensual experience in itself is bad. It's clinging to it. It's wanting the pleasurable, clinging to what is pleasant to the senses. And of course, in the Buddha thought, the mind regarded the mind as a sense. So it's what's pleasing to the body and the mind. And, you know, we're often flooded by that. If you think about kind of our ordinary experience of constant stimulation, we are flooded by appeals to having pleasurable physical and mental and audio experiences. Now, people are always walking around with, you know, earbuds in and always getting reinforcing that tendency toward the pleasant. The flood of becoming. And again, because the Ganges did flood, this would have been a really significant metaphor for the time. The flood of becoming. Becoming is all about self-identification. It's about what we identify with, who we think we are. It might be career, it might be family role, it might be our status, but this idea of becoming, the self constantly reinforcing its existence. The flood of views, of always having opinions, of always divvying up right and wrong. And if you remember at the beginning, the Buddha said, you know, divide things into skillful, unskillful. And something that might be skillful in one circumstance might not be skillful in another, as with, you know, this idea of pedagogy, that the Buddha spoke to his students in the way that would have made, would be appropriate for the particular students that he was working with. So the flood of views. And finally, the flood of ignorance, which is sort of the base of our mistaken endeavors. There's also a very interesting discussion that the Buddha had about how he crossed the flood. And he says, the Buddha was asked, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood." This is, I think we first read, so what did he do? Like, he moved, like, really slowly? But this is an example of the Buddha's middle way. He transcended. He didn't identify with either extreme. This is the subtle middle way. He transcended the two extremes. He crossed the flood by non-identification with self, with time, and with location, that he was able to extricate himself from the flood by this complete abandonment of clinging. So that may seem a little metaphysical, but it's an interesting way that's that the ultimate solution to our being flooded by sensuality, by becoming, by ignorance, by views. If we as practitioners work with the Eightfold Path, eventually we get to transcend these sorts of dualities, these sorts of entrapments. And the Buddha says, and I think this is inspiring and helpful, he says, just as the river Ganges inclines toward the east, the person who practices the Noble Eightfold Path is inclined toward Nibbana. So this is a very helpful river image, that if we continue to practice, this is a path with a goal. And you know, the Buddha often talks about the first stage of awakening is stream entry. It's having the confidence to really embrace the path. So these are images that are very very helpful, I think, in helping us give some shape to our practice. And I'm just going to conclude with an image that I personally use that I found is really helpful. I've loved this image of a river. And sometimes when I sit at home by myself in the morning, I really think, okay, at this moment, all over the world, there are people who are just like me, just sitting with the intention to awaken. And then I really get, when I think about like, taking refuge in the Sangha, that the Sangha is this great river of practitioners from the past and then the present, and this is going to go into the future. And that I really do have this image of myself being part of this river, of just being subsumed by it. Like the ultimate is to just merge into this great cause of this great force of a benefit to the world. So the image of the river as the place where practitioners are in motion has just been something that's been a great source of inspiration, of really having this ideal of completely letting go of that sense of I, mine, or me, and really being free. So that's what I have to say about some of these metaphors, and I hope that you'll share ideas that you have about them, or if you have questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them. But maybe some of you have practiced with some of these images and have some experience that you could share. I'm sorry.
I like the ending where you're talking about the struggle, the Buddha was talking about the struggle and not to struggle and to persist. But in a society where we feel like if we struggle harder, we are more justification to succeed. Or feeling like you might be on a path, if we struggle harder, it will be better or easier to succeed. So where as a long term meditator, do you find reinforcing messages that say is the persistence, not the struggle, that allows you to be better?
That's a really, I think you sort of, I'm not sure I can find the image, but you've said it exactly. It's the persistence, and sometimes it's just there's a book that I will. I enjoyed reading it, so I guess I'm saying I recommend it. It's called 10% Happier by Dan Harris. It was on the New York bestseller list, and he describes his first 10-day retreat at Spirit Rock. He's an anchor on Nightline, I think, and he does Good Morning America or something. But anyway, and he talks about having this miserable time on retreat, and he finally goes and sees a teacher, I think it was Spring Washington that he saw, and it was a retreat that had Joseph Kamala, people that we've all listened to on tape or read their books, and he doesn't always have flattering things to say about them, but it's an interesting book. He said that she talked about him, you know, trying too hard, of just sort of making peace with how things are, of just really trying to accept that. And, you know, in in my own life, before I started practice, I had an idea that relationships, especially, that the way to judge a relationship was by how much people struggled in it and then managed to stay together. Like, if we didn't... My husband's sitting in the back with a big smile on his face about this. But I just had this idea that, like, what really proved that, like, you were really committed to each other, which you just sort of pick apart everything and really struggle around it and then, you know, sort of survive the wreckage to go on to another car wreck. No, just... And it just, you know, it really took me a long time. And it wasn't just the Buddha. I mean, there's other sorts of therapy to sort of get it into my head that, you know, struggle is not always the best way to proceed. But I think that there is a kind of, as you were suggesting, Sunita, kind of a cultural message that sort of struggle is a good thing. You know, we often, there's a kind of implicit value, you know, like if your calendar is just, if you are so overbooked, you know, you must be doing something right. And so I think that this is a lot about that kind of reframing. And, you know, talking about the flood of views, sometimes just kind of stepping back a little bit and, you know, just looking at what your assumptions, what your concepts are about what makes something worthwhile. But I think you really nailed it when you said, no, it's about being persistent, about having that kind of patience, in a way, to be with something and not just struggle with it. And I think for persons in here who are parents, you know, this is often an experience you have of just kind of being there for the long haul, or people who are caregivers, you know, that you just kind of reconcile yourself. You just know you're in it for the long haul. Your heart is really, really there. And trying to free yourself from that, from the views and expectations of others and the judgments of others is often challenging, which is another reason why it's great to come together to practice, because there are persons here in the room with whom you probably have a lot in common in terms of reorienting yourself toward many of the expectations and values that are so popular and at least superficially dominant. I don't know if they really are, but they seem to be superficially dominant. Thanks, Cynthia.
Mm-hmm. I really like the garden metaphor and how it can be applied to just general self-improvement projects. I think there's a paradox that you prove yourself, you first have to accept yourself, and that's what start with the garden. You have to deal with weeds, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And the best gardeners tend to know spirits, so just get weeds. Instead of just applying herbicide and killing the whole garden off, or just letting it overrun, is to pick the middle path and just learn what's the weed.
Mm-hmm.
Start clipping them. And like I said, as you gain experience, you are able to remove the weed before they really spread.
And thank you. And the other part of that is, you know, that what happens to me very often is, you know, I just don't get out to do anything for a big stretch of time, and then I have a ton of work, and stuff is pretty much overgrown. So, you know, being able to work pretty consistently, at least a little bit. You know, if you can meditate 10 minutes a day, if that's what you can do, that's better than not doing it. So, you know, that sometimes I think about, you know, I just need to give myself a big chunk of time to do a project, like get out in the garden, instead of just, you know, if I would just put 10 or 15 minutes here and do this. And I think a lot of it's the same for our practice. If we just really make the best use of every opportunity that we have. When you're sitting at the red light and someone's there with a sign asking for help, you know, just do a little meta practice for that person. And just, you know, as best you can, take that opportunity to really cultivate those seeds and those intentions in yourself. Anything else? Please.
Actually, when you mentioned the river, I thought more that this could be the way that you closed it, but that it's the flow of the river that where the metaphor lies in Hope 1. I'm not sure if you have any sense of what's going to the source.
There isn't an image in some of the suttas, and sometimes people talk about, the image works in both ways. Sometimes people talk about going against the stream. And in fact, there's a sangha, Dharma punks, in California, and they are really going against the stream. So there's a way of thinking about that image in which the stream is all the sort of popular opinion, all those forces, and that practice sometimes feels like you are going against the stream of the dominant. There are also, the idea of going to the source. But what's interesting in, the Buddha has no creation story. And the Buddha is not very interested in anything that's metaphysical. He just doesn't answer those kinds of questions. Skillful, unskillful, unskillful. Those sorts of metaphysical questions. What's the origin of stuff? Unskillful. It's not going to help you for yourself. So the idea of going to the source, he talks about, there are some suttas, at least one where he talks about sort of a mountain stream, and the mountain stream emerges and then comes to sort of an end. And he uses the mountain stream as an image of human life, in at least one sutta. But the idea of going toward an origin is not something you find very much in the suttas, except for we really want to look for, to try to understand better when we planted the seed, the origin, sort of, again, to sort of mix that river garden metaphor, the seeds of our intentions to look for, since everything is causally related, to look for the origin sometimes of something is helpful in our own behavior. Else? But thank you for the comment.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.